from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. When President Obama paid a visit to Fremont's Solyndra plant last year, it was to tout the promise of green technology. Companies like Solyndra are leading the way toward a bright future and a more prosperous future, the president said in saluting the potential of the solar panel manufacturer. But a presidential visit doesn't guarantee success. And this week, Solyndra shut down its operations and laid off 1,100 workers. On a morning when the new jobs report is dismal nationwide, we'll talk about what went wrong at Solyndra and what it says about the future of green jobs and the green economy. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. As you've been hearing this morning, the new jobs report is out, and it's awful. Zero job growth for the month of August, raising the stakes that much higher for President Obama's address to a joint session of Congress next week, where he'll unveil his new jobs plan. It's probably safe to say that the president won't talk about Solyndra in his speech. Solyndra is the Fremont-based solar panel manufacturer that the president visited last year as part of his push for green technology. But Solyndra closed its doors this week, laying off 1,100 workers. Its collapse came despite having received more than $500 million from the U.S. Department of Energy in guaranteed loans and $1 billion of private venture capital. So why did it fail? This morning, as we get ready for a renewed national debate on jobs policy, we're going to take up the Solyndra story and what that story tells us about the future of green technology and the future of government jobs policy. Joining us this morning to take up this topic, Harley Shaken. He is professor of geography and director of the Center for Latin American Studies at the University of California, Berkeley, where he also specializes in labor issues. Professor Shaken, thanks for being with us.
Good to be here.
Jesse Jenkins joins us as well. He's director of energy and climate policy for the Breakthrough Institute. Jesse, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
David Henderson, research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Mr. Henderson, thank you.
Thank you.
And Dana Hall, business reporter covering energy and clean technology for the San Jose Mercury News. Dana, thank you as well.
Good morning.
So before we get to the topic of the hour, which is the future of green technology and green jobs, I think we need to sort of put a frame around that discussion, given the news of the morning and this rather bleak, Harley Shaken, dismal, rather jobs report of no job growth during the month of August. Your reaction to the news this morning?
Dismal summarizes it. It was much lower than projected. There are always some specific issues that enter into it. But the fact that we've averaged 35,000 jobs a month for the last 3 months is very grim news and, in fact, understates the kind of damage that's out there. We know that the overall unemployment rate in the nation remains above 9%. It went up a little bit. For African-American men, it's 18% in these latest numbers. For African-American teenagers, it's 47%.
Wow.
So jobs remain a pivotal issue.
And David Henderson, your take on the news this morning?
It's pretty bad. I was looking for somewhat of an increase, and we didn't see it. So I basically agree with Harley. The one thing I would add that my guess is Harley would see this as bad news. I see this as possibly slightly hopeful, is that real wages fell slightly. And you might think, well, why is that hopeful? Well, because a big part of the problem is that wages are what Keynes called inflexible or sticky downward, and that causes employers not to hire as many people. So if wages fell even a few percent in inflation-adjusted terms, that would increase the amount of labor demanded and increase the number of jobs.
So you're suggesting that even though it sounds like bad news, that people would be making less. If people make less, there's more incentive for employers to hire?
Exactly.
Right. All right. So taking this bleak picture now, let's drill down on this one aspect of the possibility for growing jobs in this country. And there has been all this hope that green technology would be part of something that would spur greater hiring and add good jobs into the economy. And as I referenced at the beginning, Solyndra, this plant in Fremont that makes solar panels, had been part of that hope. And here's what President Obama had to say when he came to Solyndra in May of 2010 about the future that he hoped that company would represent.
We're poised to transform the ways we power our homes and our cars and our businesses, and we're poised to lead our competitors in the development of new technologies and products and businesses, and we are poised to generate countless new jobs, good-paying, middle-class jobs right here in the United States of America.
President Obama speaking in May of 2010 at the Solyndra plant, which closed this past week. Dana Hull, you were there covering that speech of the president's for the San Jose Mercury News. Give us your sense of that day juxtaposed with what happened this week.
Well, the collapse of Solyndra is stunning and incredibly sad. I think that every analyst in the solar industry knew that Solyndra, as well as many American solar manufacturers, have been struggling in recent months because of increased competition from China. But the fact that they filed for bankruptcy and laid off all 1,100 employees came as a real shock. And it just goes to show how sort of fast the company fell from being the poster child for the promise of clean energy to being the kind of poster child of everything going wrong.
When you were there that day in May of last year, was there any sense that that could happen, that this was a bit of a roll of the dice?
No, I think that there was an incredible amount of optimism. I mean, if you look at the company's history, they had raised an enormous amount of funding from the venture capital community, over $1 billion. They were the first American company to get a loan from the DOE. Vice President Biden appeared at the groundbreaking ceremony. Energy Secretary Stephen Chu was at the groundbreaking. And then Obama's visit was really kind of highlighting the fact that they were on track to build this brand new, gleaming, state-of-the-art manufacturing facility in Fremont. There was incredible optimism there.
And put in perspective now, again, in light of this very grim jobs report that came out this morning, what that means for the South Bay, for a town like Fremont that already went through, of course, the difficulties with the NUMMI plant closing in past years. What will this represent for that particular area, this closing?
Well, I think that everyone agrees that the key to creating jobs in the United States is to really bring back manufacturing to the United States. And as we know in California, that's always been difficult because of high land prices and higher labor costs. So the fact that Solyndra chose to manufacture in California was really seen as a bright spot in this effort to bring back manufacturing to California. But 1,100 people is an enormous amount of people. They were laid off without severance. Their health insurance ended immediately, and it's a huge, huge setback. And it kind of casts a pall over all the other solar companies in Silicon Valley that are trying to do the same thing. I will say that the one bright spot in Fremont is that Tesla Motors is still manufacturing, and they're still adding employees.
In the old NUMMI plant,
in fact. NUMMI plant.
Yeah. Yep. Dana Hull, a business reporter for the San Jose Mercury News. So what went wrong? Jesse Jenkins, Director of Energy and Climate Policy at the Breakthrough Institute. What went wrong in this bright promise of Solyndra?
Well, I think in hindsight, it's relatively easy to see some of the factors that contributed to the demise of Solyndra. The main innovation, the central innovation that Solyndra was advancing was a thin film solar technology that avoided the use of silicon. Refined silicon was extremely expensive at the time that Solyndra was founded in 2006, 2007. But prices for silicon have since collapsed as a large volume of new refined silicon production facilities came online over the last several years across the world. And so in the absence of that sort of cost advantage, the remaining cost advantages that Solyndra was able to get through their cylindrical solar panel design, which is their other innovation, which allowed for flat roof installations that helped increase their cost advantage as well, wasn't sufficient to keep them competitive in a market where silicon prices had collapsed and where Chinese manufacturers, with support, heavy support from the Chinese government in the form of low-cost land, if not free land, for their industrial facilities and highly subsidized, very low-interest loans to scale up their manufacturing operations, it's just squeezed Solyndra out of an intensely competitive market.
Well, let's pursue that part of it for a moment and what that may portend about the possibility of really growing a green economy when you have that competition. Harley Schick and Dana Hull mentioned the fact that one of the difficulties of doing this in California is the cost of land. And we just heard Jesse Jenkins say that part of what gives the Chinese manufacturers an advantage is they get sometimes free land from the government as well as heavily subsidized loan support. So is it not at all anything close to a level playing field? Is it going to be possible for us to really compete in this green technology area with a country like China?
Not under current circumstances. It's not that it's not a level playing field. The Chinese have excluded us from the stadium in this regard. What they are doing isn't simply providing low-cost land on occasion. They're providing low-cost land in all cases among many, many other government subsidies that result in 95% of their solar production being exported and dominating half the global market. And it may just be the beginning. So the real issue here is if those rules don't change, then no one will be able to compete from the U.S. or perhaps most other countries in the world, and the Chinese will ultimately dominate the market. It creates a downward spiral that's very difficult to get out of.
When you say if the rules don't change, are you talking about the rules by which China plays, or are you talking about the rules that we create here?
Both, really. The rules by which China plays are its own. They have essentially set the standard, and the leader of one major Chinese solar firm mentioned in a newspaper interview the other day, look, the world ought to be grateful to us because we're lowering the cost of solar material, we're addressing climate change. And he's using that as the excuse for flouting all World Trade Organization rules in this area, which the U.S. and many other countries adhered to. The Chinese are highly unlikely to change on that. So I think it puts a burden on U.S. policy to essentially say, okay, if the Chinese are indicating these are the rules we will play by in terms of strong support for a domestic industry that has critical implications for the economy, important security dimensions, and addresses the issue of climate change, which is urgent, to essentially lower the cost of manufacturing from a U.S. base.
And David Henderson, what would you want to see then in the way of rule changes within the United States? Or would you? Do you think that the prospects for green technology are possible for us to support, or is it kind of a pipe dream?
Well, I want to answer that, but I want to just circle back briefly. Dana said something that's absolutely false. She said that everyone agrees that the key to more jobs is to bring back manufacturing, and not everyone agrees with that. In particular, a whole lot of economists, whatever their ideology, don't agree with that. Just as the key to bringing back jobs in the United States in the 20th century was not to bring back agriculture. We went from 40% of the people being employed in agriculture around 1900 to 2% now. The other related point is every manufacturing country in the world is losing manufacturing jobs, including China. And it's not because of trade. It's because of increased productivity in manufacturing. And so, no, the key is not to bring back manufacturing jobs. The key is to, I think, to have free markets. Now, to your question about the Chinese and trade and so on, the people who lose most from the Chinese subsidies are the Chinese taxpayers. Essentially, what they're doing or what their government is doing is giving us a form of foreign aid. I mean, it's kind of weird foreign aid from one of the relatively poor countries in the world to one of the richest countries in the world, but that's what they're doing. And I don't want them to do it. I care about Chinese taxpayers, but I don't think we should reject the help when it's offered.
David Henderson, research fellow at Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Dan Hall at the San Jose Mercury News, I have a different question I want to pose for you. But if you'd like, rejoin on David Henderson's point that you're not correct, that the key is manufacturing jobs.
Well, I think if you look at the stimulus funds that were passed by Congress, one of the sort of goals of that program was to bring back manufacturing to the United States. I would respectfully disagree. I think that manufacturing is important if you want to have a diverse economy.
And Jesse Jenkins, what would you like to see President Obama pivot to at this point when he makes a speech next week? Do you think that green technology can still be part of his push for creating jobs?
I definitely think it can. And I think just to respond briefly out of the point about manufacturing and its role in the U.S. economy, this is different than agriculture. Advanced manufacturing in particular, the kind of manufacturing that high-tech firms like Solyndra, like First Solar, another U.S. solar leader and thin film producer, that kind of advanced manufacturing is a critical part of the innovation ecosystem in this country that helps us develop new technologies, new industries, and improve the productivity of the U.S. economy. If we hollow out our advanced manufacturing base and simply cede that to the free market, which is hardly free when China is actively subsidizing its own manufacturing, then we lose out on the innovation engine that's always driven America forward in our economy. And I think that would be incredibly short-sighted.
So the key is what kind of manufacturing? That's what's key to growing jobs?
The key is what kind of manufacturing and driving the innovation engine in America forward as fast as possible. We cannot compete if we stand still. We know that. And in the solar and renewable energy industries in particular, we have to be continually driving down the costs of these technologies through better innovation, better designs, better manufacturing processes. And that's what the Department of Energy is trying to do here. Solyndra is one of a portfolio of investments, over 36 conditional or closed loan guarantees from the loan guarantee program on its own. So this is a part of a portfolio approach, and we really can't judge the success or failure of that approach, which the administration has been advancing, from the failure of one individual firm, just like we wouldn't condemn the entire venture capital industry because it makes one failed bet on a high-tech, high-risk reward.
Let's talk more about that. David Henderson first, because I suspect you're not a fan of loan guarantees. And again, where this gets us in terms of the future of government policy and what we can do to encourage jobs in a time when we're not growing jobs. So what's your view on the viability and the usefulness of those sorts of loan guarantee programs?
Yeah, I do want to address that. Let me just say that I was disagreeing with Dana's exact statement, which is that everyone agrees that manufacturing, and she's saying she thinks manufacturing is the key. Well, I'm not disagreeing that she thinks that. I just said it's not true that everyone agrees, especially a lot of economists. But no, I think the problem is that when you put the government in the role of venture capitalist, I think Jesse's right. You can't judge it badly based on one case, but we have way more than one case. We have the SynFuels program of the late 70s under Jimmy Carter. Roger Noel, an economist at Stanford University, has written a book just detailing just case after case of where government just wasted capital. Because what is happening is that government is being put in the role of central planner. Government officials who don't have their own wealth at stake are trying to say, okay, we think here's where the technology is going to go. We think this is where the market's going to go. And they make mistakes with taxpayers' money. Venture capitalists, on the other hand, make mistakes with their own money. And they, therefore, have a stronger incentive to get it right. And no one knows. No one knows for sure. The essence of the market is it's a discovery process, an entrepreneurial process, where people try to figure out what people want or what will work, what won't work, and they often make mistakes. But the idea, the great virtue of a free market is that people have their own wealth at stake, and therefore they don't go and waste other people's money.
Harley Shaken, a response?
Well, first, I disagree on the manufacturing front very strongly. I would agree with Dana and the issues that Jesse brought out. An advanced manufacturing base is vital for our future. 70% of research and development in this country is funded by manufacturing. To say that manufacturing goes, we lose research and development, and then we will once again become an agricultural economy versus really engaging in the world as we know it. That said, I think David is laying out a highly ideological view of the role of markets. Clearly, the Chinese don't believe that. They know the market is a very powerful and useful tool, but they also know government has a real role to play, and the combination of market and government is critical. One might say that the government was being a central planner under President Eisenhower when we did the interstate highway system. Why not wait for entrepreneurs to put in toll roads? The interstate highway system laid the basis for very strong national development. The internet comes out of government programs. There are endless innovations that do, and a lot of blind alleys. There were a lot of highways that were built which weren't in the best direction. But I think overall, where you have an urgent national need, such as clean energy, and where you have a temporary differential in cost that is making the process very slow, then government has a real critical role to play, not to pick winners and losers, but to put a broad program out there. That is precisely what the Chinese are doing. And it's not as a disadvantage to their taxpayer because it has stimulated 9% growth in the Chinese economy. And it isn't their productivity that's doing that. The productivity in many U.S. photovoltaic or solar producers is higher than their Chinese counterpart. The issue is the huge subsidies on land, on transportation, on other incentives that make their overall cost far lower. That's not a productivity issue. It's a government aid issue.
So where do we aim that government aid, or in David Henderson's view, not aim it in a way that's going to move the needle best? I mean, if you look at the record of what's happened over the last couple of years, we haven't changed the numbers. Unemployment has continued to go up. We see in this latest jobs report no job growth, Jesse Jenkins. So where should that aid go that's going to start moving the needle in the right direction?
Well, speaking specifically about the clean energy sector, actually, we have seen the needle move substantially. A recent report called Sizing the Clean Economy out of the Brookings Institution lays a really comprehensive map of where clean energy jobs have been created across the country and at what pace. And what that's shown is that during the recession, the clean economy, the clean tech sector in particular, wind, solar, renewables, actually grew in a countercyclical fashion. They grew far faster than overall job creation throughout the economy and really surged over the last 2 or 3 years with the help of that public-private partnership that was established by the stimulus funds. Now, the challenge that we face is that for every dollar we're investing in our entrepreneurs and in our firms here in the United States, China's investing 2 or 3. And our program was a temporary stimulus. It was the Recovery Act funds run out mostly by the end of this year. And so the question we have is, what is the long-term technology policy strategy that we have here to help support U.S. entrepreneurs and firms drive down the cost of their technologies, improve productivity, and compete in a globally and intensely competitive global market here so that we can create jobs here in the United States? That requires the kind of portfolio approach towards potential high-risk but also high-reward technology ventures. And that's exactly what the Loan Guarantee Program is doing. The DOE has a program called Sunshot, like a moonshot for solar power, that aims to drive down the cost of solar to be cost-competitive without further subsidy. Those are exactly the kinds of initiatives we need to make clean energy cheap enough to compete.
Jesse Jenkins, Director of Energy and Climate Policy at the Breakthrough Institute. Denihal, I know you have to leave us at the break here. We're coming up on that. But just a last quick word from you in personal way, if you could, about where this leaves Fremont and what the sense of that community is right now as yet another thing seems to go wrong for people who are looking for those kinds of manufacturing jobs.
Well, I think that many of the workers at Solyndra are devastated. My understanding is that they showed up for work on Wednesday morning and were locked out and, you know, taken to a private room where they were given the news and, you know, some people were given a few minutes to collect their belongings. But this just really came as a shock. I mean, typically you would expect there to be a round of layoffs, but not a complete filing for Chapter 11. And so I think, once again, Fremont is sort of reeling from, you know, losing so many employees, and now you have this enormous factory on 880.
Yeah.
Who's going to buy it?
Yeah, and we'll have to leave it there. But thank you for giving us that look at what's going on there. We'll come back and take your calls in just a moment as we talk about the future of jobs. This is Forum.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, the future of green technology, green economy, green jobs, especially within the news this morning that the jobs growth rate for the month of August was zero, something that has people highly concerned about what is the right thing to do at this point. Governor, or rather President Obama, will speak to this next week when he addresses a joint session of Congress about the future of jobs and what he thinks government should do. We want to focus this hour on the role of green technology and green jobs in particular. We'd welcome your comments at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Forum at kqed.org is our address. Jesse Jenkins, it's important, I think, in these sort of circumstances to try to tease out the right lesson. You can look at the fact that Solyndra failed, that actually three solar companies failed in the past month, and say, well, that's not the right direction to go in. Or to say they got $500 million in loan guarantees and it failed, that's not the right direction to go in. What do you tease out of this? What comes clear to you, becomes clear to you in light of Solyndra's failure?
Well, I mean, I think we need to, again, step back and say, you know, if this is the government playing venture capitalist, and I think in this case it is in the public interest to develop both the solar industry for the jobs and public benefits from that, but also from the energy, national energy interests here to diversify our energy base. So we have a public interest here. We're investing towards that public interest in a portfolio of companies. Some of those companies are failing now and many are succeeding. And so when I look at it, it's easy to focus in on Solyndra, but I think, you know, we need to judge it based on the overall portfolio. And we have firms like First Solar, SunPower, Bright Source Energy, based also in Oakland here in the Bay Area, that are also recipients of federal support and are moving forward substantially, creating jobs, trading competitively in a global market. And so if you look at the portfolio as a whole, I think it's easier to see that this remains a strategic growth sector, that the strategies that we've employed are not a failure, even though individual bets may not pan out. The rewards of the portfolio continue to outweigh the individual failures, although that, you know, doesn't change the situation on the ground for individual communities like Fremont.
Tom writes in, they built shiny new buildings in Fremont instead of conserving capital, using existing buildings and developing a technology that would give them a competitive advantage. One of the things that seems to be true, David Henderson, is that they may have placed their bets in the wrong way. Jesse was referring to the fact that they placed their bets on a different kind of technology than what is going to shake out. Tom is raising this point about whether or not they invested in the right way. Is that what you take from this? That's the reason we shouldn't have these big government loans, because you're placing them in companies that may not make the right choices?
Well, yeah, but even more, I mean, that's a way of putting it. What I said is that essentially you're putting the government in the role of central planner, and government doesn't have, the government officials don't have the information they need. That information is generated only by an entrepreneurial process, and then it's made worse by the fact that they are basically subsidizing various players, and apparently with some issue of political pull, like this guy Kaiser, who was a big fundraiser for Obama, who's one of the big investors. And so you have a mixture of political pull, bad decisions based on limited information with other people's money, and the result is going to be a bad result. And of course, as Tom says in his email question, or his email point, one of the things they'll do, of course, when they're spending other people's money is make it look really nice.
And let's go to our call. Sarah joins us first from New Lisbon, Wisconsin. Sarah, go ahead.
I was interested in the panel's thoughts. You know, we've been having a lot of discussions about using money as specifically as a way of driving these businesses. But to me, it seems that we should be focused more on policy like a renewable electricity standard that's really going to push the market towards these clean technologies and therefore creating a lot of clean energy jobs.
Sarah, thanks. Harley Shaken?
I think that's a very thoughtful comment. I don't think these are mutually exclusive goals. I really think we need both. I would like to respond to something that David said about, you know, the government playing central planner. Private capital put $1 billion into Solyndra, double the government's investment. That was their money. They were wrong. That's inherent when you're trying new things. We have two things in this country that are really unique and reflect great entrepreneurial energy in the past and strong public policy. We have a lead in research and development in the solar energy industry. And we have the premier manufacturing base in the world. To the extent that we can bring these two together and we have public policy that advances that, we could define the solar energy going forward, the solar industry going forward. That will require policy such as that your caller mentioned on the usage side, but the notion of that this money that went into the loans for Solyndra is poorly used is not the right idea. As Jesse pointed out, there were 36 loans that are out there. The issue should be about $18 billion is involved in this now. It should be far more than that. Clearly, new expenditures are off the political map right now, but that's a mistake because this isn't spending money. Simply, it is investing in the future in an industry that is critical to us as a nation.
So in a word, Harley Shaken, what should President Obama say next week that he probably won't?
Okay. Well, I think there's a number of things he should say that he probably won't, but one might be the need for jobs is urgent. It will define our future. The need for green energy is a critical national need. Let's bring them together and create a Green Progress Administration. It is a Works Progress Administration, the WPA of FDR and the New Deal for the 21st century. It invests in creating new forms of solar energy, among others. It puts people to work. And to show this, we are going to allocate funds to put solar roofs on all new federal buildings and on all new schools in the United States. Puts people to work immediately in construction and manufacturing, provides a more secure energy future.
And David Henderson, Jesse Jenkins, I'm going to give you a chance to answer the same question in a bit, but I want to get more of our callers involved, and then I'll hear your take on what you think President Obama should say and that he might probably not actually communicate. Robert joins us next in San Francisco. Robert, go ahead.
Yeah, good morning. Conservative economists such as the folks from the Hoover Institution push free trade and push lowering our trade barriers on the ground that when the level playing field is level, then the good companies will survive. That's the theory behind comparative advantage. One. But then, when the Chinese government subsidizes companies, they say it's a form of aid to us. It's really like talking out of both sides of their mouth. What's really going on is that the Chinese government cares about jobs, the U.S. government cares about jobs, but it's hampered by Hoover Institution economists who claim we should keep lowering our trade barriers till all of our jobs go overseas. I just think it's outrageous. They should be called on this.
Robert, thank you. David Henderson.
Yeah, it's not speaking about out of both sides of my mouth. It's handling a couple of different questions. I agree that Chinese subsidies distort comparative advantage. Point made. It's also true that Chinese subsidies are a form of foreign aid. So would I rather, as I said, I've already answered, would I rather have the Chinese not subsidize and save the taxpayers money and get comparative advantage working? Yes, I would. But absent that, it is a form of foreign aid. I also want to go back and, you've given, Dave, you've given Harley a lot of chances to answer questions more than you've given me. So I just want to go back. Harley made a statement that I'm coming at this from an ideology. And it is true. I do have an ideology. I believe in freedom. I believe in free markets. But almost nothing I've said, virtually nothing I've said, has to do with that ideology. It has to do with basic economics. And no one who's challenged my point about manufacturing jobs has really challenged it. I said that manufacturing might not be the key to future jobs. I didn't say we won't have a growing manufacturing sector. That's why I made the point about the Chinese. That's why I said the Chinese, who no one thinks are doing badly at manufacturing, are losing manufacturing jobs because it's productivity. So we get boom in manufacturing in the United States. I wouldn't be surprised if we do, and we probably won't have any new manufacturing jobs, which is why I pointed to the case of agriculture. Agriculture is not an industry that declined in the United States. It grew, and it grew with the labor force in agriculture going from 40% down to 2%.
David?
David Henderson, research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. A lot of interesting emails coming in. Let me go through a couple. Why did America get behind the highway system and the moonshot? How do we create a similar excitement and commitment? Your guests have given examples of failed government investment, but on the winning side of the balance sheet, the government can offer the following: the interstate highway system, the internet, global position systems and other satellite-based communication systems, containerized global shipping containers, microchips. And another email from David writes in, the Chinese are not an example of brilliant government planners. They haven't developed an internet through government R&D. Rather, they are mercantilist bullies. Does the proponent of government investment think we should supply free land to our solar manufacturers? Should we race to the bottom, matching subsidy to subsidy? So on that point, Jesse Jenkins, how do you respond to that emailer's challenge that we don't want to get into that kind of fight with the Chinese? It takes us to the bottom, not the top.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. I think the other emails that you raised highlight exactly the role that the federal government has historically played, and I think this runs exactly counter to what David's been talking about. You know, it's not just basic economics. This is basic history of the United States and our economic progress and prosperity. The government has routinely, from George Washington to George W. Bush, invested in early-stage strategic industries, not as a central planner, but as an effort to help entrepreneurs and winners emerge from that sector through competitive forces. So we support early stage R&D, that we know that the risk reward sort of structure precludes the right amount of private sector investment. And we help work as an early customer for emerging technologies, whether it's microchips or computers or GPS, that then creates platform technologies that the private sector can innovate on, creating tons of jobs. So what we need to do is not sort of blanketly subsidize yesterday's technologies, which largely is what China's doing here, but be smart about a technology strategy that helps our entrepreneurs, our researchers, and our innovative firms succeed in developing the new technologies that will drive forward American prosperity in the 21st century the way we have throughout our nation's history.
And David Henderson, we've heard you comment on what you think government should not do, but what should it do?
Mainly get out of the way, and let me go back to the highway system. Harley made an incorrect statement. He said we were waiting for all these toll roads to come along before the interstate system. We weren't waiting at all, and in fact, the interstate highway system that Eisenhower started pushed out the toll roads that various state governments were making, that private firms were building, and so on. So we did have this road network growing much more in response to market demand than Eisenhower, who wanted to do it because of a trip he took in 1919.
So are you saying that we shouldn't have developed the interstate system?
But the government should not have developed the interstate system. And in fact, there's a book out by a Santa Clara economist, Alex Field, pointing out that, you know, people think the interstate highway system was this big deal because we didn't have an international national highway system. We did. And in fact, if you look at I-95, it was built right over US-1. I mean, Eisenhower made this decision in the 50s based on an experience he had as a young Army officer in 1919. It's like he didn't notice that there were about 36 years in between when highways developed.
And back to our calls. Paul in Santa Clara is next. Paul, go ahead.
Hi. One of the problems we're going to have with manufacturing and exports in particular is we still snub the international metric system. And so a lot of businesses internationally just don't want our products. I've had a number of conversations where businessmen were like, well, we could have bought products from you, but we weren't sure what measurement system we were going to get. So we just took you out of the race.
Paul, thanks. Thanks for the question. We've gotten a couple of emails on that as well. Harley Shagan, why don't you respond to that? And I just bet you're going to also say something about the interstate system.
No, actually, I want to be unpredictable. I'm going to say I don't think we really need to debate the wisdom of the interstate system versus toll roads right now. I think we can leave that settled by history itself. All I was going to say on this issue, David earlier said he's for freedom, he's for free markets. I am too, but we have to put them in a pragmatic context. We have extraordinary entrepreneurs in this country, research and development, but we need a public role, not to emulate the Chinese, but to ensure that a pivotal industry for the future, in this case photovoltaics,
goes where it can. And with that public aid and our entrepreneurial energy, I think we could define this globally as well as in the United States.
And to
the issue of the metric system.
Yeah, because it sounds like a small point, but maybe we've gotten a couple of emails on it. It sounds like maybe it is something that we should be more considerate of.
It's a factor, but not the only factor. For example, there's a company, there's a solar company in Michigan, Unisolar, where most of its production is sold in Germany. So it's a U.S. company selling in Europe, where the metric system is clearly dominant. So could this be a factor? It is. I don't think it is a defining factor for the problems in the industry right now.
Paul, thanks for the call. Let's go to Greg next in San Jose. Greg, go ahead.
I'm Greg Smithstead. I have been a reviewer for the loan guarantee program in solar energy, as well as many of the other solar programs that are being funded. And I have to say that the bureaucrats don't pick any winners. They pick reviewers, experts in the field from technology, engineering, business. They do extensive due diligence. It's a very rigorous process for both the loan guarantee and many others. And in fact, just yesterday, the awards continue. $145 million for the Sunshot program was just released. 69 projects in 24 states. So the idea that there are Washington bureaucrats who are picking winners is wrong.
Greg, were you involved in reviewing by any chance the Solyndra loan guarantee?
Well, I couldn't say that if I was or not, but I am very familiar with the process of the peer review. I'm an editor for Solar Energy Journal, so I do international peer review as well as here in the United States.
Okay.
So that's the important part, is that these projects go through extensive vetting. But, of course, just like in any portfolio, sometimes you pick something and the market conditions change, and as we've talked about in the program.
Yeah, Greg, thanks for the call. David Henderson, you want to respond?
Yeah, Greg didn't. I mean, I would have expected that's the way the program worked. I'd be shocked if it didn't, but he certainly didn't contradict anything I said. I said that government picks these firms. He's telling about the process, how government picks it. So they get people who are thought of as experts in the field, and they make their decisions. But again, my major point was they're trying to do it based on limited information, and they're not doing it based – they're not putting their own wealth at risk. I mean, I'd be much more impressed. You know, Harley did make one good point, which is that two-thirds of the funding for this was venture capitalists. I'm glad it was that much. I think we would have had an even worse situation if it hadn't been. But I want to see 100% of the funds be people voluntarily putting these funds up rather than have the government take it from some and give it to others.
Yeah, Jesse Jenkins.
Yeah, just to respond to David's point about, you know, consistently saying that the government just needs to get out of the way and help the private sector succeed. I mean, here we are in the Bay Area, Silicon Valley being the real engine of the economy for much of the last century here. The U.S. government essentially helped build Silicon Valley by creating the early demand for microchips, for radio tubes technology before that, and by funding the research and computer science programs that seeded this entire industry. So if we play out David's logic and say government just needs to get out of the way, then you know the entire vibrant U.S. IT and computing industries, and including the vibrancy here in Silicon Valley, probably never would have developed, because those technologies were pre-commercial. They were too expensive for private sector demand to generate the interest there. We helped catalyze this emerging growth sector. We've done it from time and time again, all the way back to George Washington, helping get interchangeable parts, which revolutionized manufacturing, which were first seeded by U.S. public armories to develop rifle interchangeable parts for rifle technology. So this is how the U.S. government does this. This is how our economy grows. And to sort of say we need to get out of the way means we're going to seed all sorts of opportunities for new technologies and growth, and we can't really afford to do that.
So let me come back now, and David Henderson, and give you a crack at the question I posed to Harley Shaken earlier, which is, what should President Obama say about this very point that Jesse Jenkins is making? What should he say on Thursday night that you think he probably won't say?
Well, okay, so I think government should get out of the way, and I think, you know, Jesse might be making a good point about how we wouldn't have had Silicon Valley develop exactly the way it did. He probably might say it wouldn't have developed at all, I don't know that, without government support. I think there's something to that. But there was a French economic journalist, and I'd love for Obama to read this guy before he gives the talk, about 200 years ago, named Bastiat, who wrote an article called What is Seen and What is Not Seen. And so when we look at what government did, that's seen. And so if we look at all of these successes, people say, oh, wow, that's great. But what we don't get is what economists call opportunity cost. What would have been done if that hadn't been done? So if government hadn't put those resources there, what would have happened? I mean, I think we'd be further at getting to the moon, or sorry, getting into outer space, if government hadn't monopolized it with NASA in the late 1950s. And so you've always got to say, what would have happened instead? And you can't just assume a blank slate. So I would love for Obama to read the whole of this 20 or 30 page article, which you can find online, Bastiat, B-A-S-T-I-A-T, about what is seen and what is not seen, and really take it to heart, because I think Obama has what Friedrich Hayek, the Nobel Prize winning economist, called the fatal conceit. He thinks he's way smarter than he is. Now, he's a smart man, but no one on this call, no one in this world is smart enough to make those kinds of decisions about specific investments all over the economy.
And let's hear what some of our listeners would like to contribute to this. Here's Doug, who writes in, it's much easier to identify the problem, i.e. non-renewable energy, than to develop an alternative. Tax non-renewable energy so that the renewable energy solutions have a cost advantage. The market will then winnow out the best alternatives. Adam writes, doesn't foreign aid generally go to governments? If so, how would Chinese subsidies due to their own industries qualify as foreign aid? I'm not trying to be snarky here, but that sounds like a specious argument. And Craig writes in, could you please ask your guests, when I drive through the ultra-wealthy communities like Atherton, Portola Valley, Hillsborough, or the mansions of the Monterey Peninsula, I never see any solar panels. Until the rich incorporate solar as a natural part of their mansions, does solar as an industry really have a chance? Even Obama has not put the solar panels back on the White House that Carter put up and Reagan took down. And back to our calls. Michael in San Jose has our next thought. Michael, go ahead.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, I just wanted to say that, you know, when I came from Brazil 20 years ago, you know, it was still made in USA was still something highly respected in the world, and this has disappeared amidst, you know, all of this trickle down in Milton Friedmanism, and with that, the middle class is also disappearing. What I wanted to say is that expecting free market to take care of it and saying that government should get out, it's not ideological. It's just plain about it. It's just plain dollars. It's all about money. It's all about a smaller and smaller number of companies and a smaller and smaller number of people making a whole lot of money, exporting a whole lot of jobs to China and to other places. You know, and the fact that these guys who are promoting this, they play to the average American's naivete, and the average American tries to find a scapegoat for what's going on with this country. And
Michael,
they blame government.
Yeah, Michael, thank you. I'm going to hold you there because I want to use the first part of what you said as sort of a last takeoff point for all of us, which is Michael's observation, hardly shaken, about that there used to be more that he found that was made in the USA. And this gets us back, I think, to this question of the future of manufacturing and where we ought to sort of try to solve this terrible jobs problem that we're so confronted by in this country right now, and that was reaffirmed by that tough jobs report this morning. So where does it make sense to sort of try to make made in the USA something that can work again?
It makes most sense in the industry we're talking about, solar energy, renewable energy for the future. And let me mention one specific individual who gives us real cause for optimism going forward. One of the pioneers of this entire industry, Stan Ovshinsky, a scientist and innovator from Michigan. Most of us have never heard of him. He developed the nickel metal hydride battery. It was dismissed in the early 90s. Toyota adopted it, and made an industry out of it. All the Priuses ran on that battery. He did the pioneering work on solar energy. The Beijing Museum in China uses those panels on its roof. With that kind of entrepreneurial energy here, putting together a public-private partnership to provide the access going forward, the loan guarantees that President Obama so extolled at Solyndra are as valid today. The issue is a broader portfolio. Some will fail, but many more will succeed. That could define a future in which the U.S. continues to lead in research and development, continues to lead in manufacturing, and provides jobs. Jeff Immelt, the CEO of General Electric, points out there's no reason we couldn't have 20% of our gross domestic product, that is, of the economy, in manufacturing. It's about 11 or 12% today. The possibilities are there. The entrepreneurial energy is there. What we need is informed public policy that gives us a public-private partnership going forward that can create these jobs and address these energy issues.
And David Henderson, a brief, please, last thought from you on the Made in USA.
I'm not convinced he's right. I mean, I think he's right in the sense that other countries have come up in quality. So I remember in the 60s, if someone said Made in Japan, it was like, wow, that's going to be a lousy product. And of course, by the late 70s, early 80s, that had changed dramatically. But the point is that the people in various parts of the world will figure out ways of doing things well. And even if it were the case that Made in the USA doesn't mean quite the quality it used to mean, that doesn't bother me. Again, we will buy them from where we think we can get the best deal, and that will determine where those things are produced, and that's fine.
And Jesse Jenkins, last to you and your opportunity to answer the question about what you'd like President Obama to say that he probably won't.
I think he needs to say that an idea that we're going to cut the deficit by putting everything on the table is fundamentally flawed. The federal government needs to make smart investments in our nation's future, even as we cut back on some of the spending that is more sort of consumptive in the near term. So we need to make smart investments in growth, in innovation, in productivity, and in competitiveness. And that means investing in R&D, and it means investing in world-class human capital through our educational system, and it means investing in a public-private partnership for national advanced manufacturing competitiveness and supporting the kinds of firms that can lead American manufacturing forward.
Jesse Jenkins, Director of Energy and Climate Policy for the Breakthrough Institute. He joined us along with David Henderson, Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, Harley Shaken, Professor of Geography and Director of the Center for Latin American Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. Thanks all for participating with us, along with Dana Hall, business reporter for the San Jose Mercury News, who joined us in our first half hour. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.